You know, when you search for something on Netflix, what you get is only a fraction of what they really have? The streaming service actually has more than 18,000 titles globally, but only about 6,000 of those are available in the good old US of A. That means you're missing out on literally thousands of great shows. Unless, of course, you use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that lets you change your online location, protecting your devices from unwanted snooping and allowing you to control where streaming services and other websites think you're located. There are over 100 different locations to choose from, which means you have access to thousands of new shows and movies no matter where you live. This doesn't just work with Netflix, it works with Disney Plus, Hulu, Max, a UK streamer called BBC iPlayer, and more. I was on a work trip in the UK during the final season of Game of Thrones, and I tried logging into my HBO account to watch a new episode, but the technology wouldn't let me because of geo-blocking. And I wish I had this app at that moment, because I now realize how incredibly easy it is to work around that problem. Here's a more recent example. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is not streaming on Netflix in the US, but I just fired up the episode where Dennis tries to have a peaceful mental health day, and technology keeps interrupting his plans. All I had to do was open ExpressVPN, connect to a UK server, refresh Netflix, and the show just popped up. It's super easy. I've also heard good things about that show called Billions, but I've never been a Showtime subscriber, so I've never seen it. But it's actually available right now on Netflix in South Korea, and with ExpressVPN, it took 5 seconds to switch over and start checking it out. With ExpressVPN, you get high-quality streaming from devices like your phone, laptop, tablet, and TV, and crucially, it protects your privacy and security to keep your information safe from hackers. Stop missing out on great TV and get thousands of new shows with ExpressVPN. We got them to give you all 3 extra months free when you use our special link, expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film to get 3 extra months completely free.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for Thursday, October 27th, 2022. On today's episode, we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion about Tales of the Jedi, the new short-form animated series on Disney+. This is Slash Film editorial director Peter Ceretta, and joining me on today's podcast is Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And Star Wars expert Brian Young.
I'm so thrilled to be here.
Okay, guys, I'm going to be honest with you. This is the thing that I don't think I was too excited about. And not that like I wasn't, you know, anything Star Wars excites me, but I was kind of like, oh, it's going to be a bunch of shorts. Like, I think the shorts on Disney Plus have kind of let me down. Like those I Am Groot things. They like seem so disposable, like especially how they like present them on the platform. But, you know, giving my brief reaction to this, I was kind of blown away by this series, and I hope they do more of it because it was so good. And actually, Brian, tell me this: is the animation in the series that much better than Rebels and Clone Wars? Because it looks like it to me. Like,
yeah. So it's funny. As we were waiting to record this, I was writing up my coverage, and I was literally just typing the words before we started recording that every time this animation team has taken a new bite of the apple, they manage to improve their animation style and their lighting by leaps and bounds every time. And this is no exception. Like, this does look that much better than Rebels, and it looks that much better than even the most recent season of Clone Wars that they sort of did just a couple of years ago. Or yes. It's just every frame is a painting, and it just looks terrific.
Especially the backgrounds. The backgrounds feel like and look like old school map paintings to me. And I just love the fantasy kind of almost samurai feeling of this show.
Yeah.
And
it's especially in the last episode, like they really played up, like Kevin kind of really played up like the Kurosawa style music with the drums and that it was just really good.
I will say, I'm going to take one knock at Andor here. It's my nitpick is watching this show and even like the small little bites of it that we get reinforced, like seeing the galaxy populated with so many alien creatures, alien species, droids. It really solidified my biggest nitpick about Andor, like not having any of those things or like having very little of those things.
I will say that's one of the reasons that this animation kind of gets better and better every time is because once they've built an asset, like this was something when I was interviewing the Clone Wars crew quite a bit, is like they didn't have money to populate the backgrounds of the aliens and stuff. So if you notice in earlier seasons, they wouldn't really have that. And then they'd do a big arc and it would be like, well, we need all the Mon Calamari. And then all of a sudden, that episode would pay for them to rig all of the Mon Calamari so they could use them in perpetuity. And so now, after 7 seasons of Clone Wars and 4 of Rebels and some of Resistance, they have all the assets to do all of that much more cheaply and cost-effectively than they ever have. But, you know, it's animation too. So, like, once you build that Mon Calamari mask or that Rodian mask, you have it forever and you can tweak it with... You know, with Andor, it's live action. You still have to pay someone guild rates to get into the costume, and someone has to build it, and so on and so forth.
Okay, Brad, what is your brief reaction for Tales of the Jedi?
Well, I'm going to be a little bit of a naysayer here because I thought that this was just okay. I'm going to be honest. I am not the biggest fan of the animation style that is used and has been used from Clone Wars through Rebels and this. I will agree that I think that the backgrounds and environments look fantastic. I do like the artistic style there, but there's something about the texture of the characters and like sometimes their movement feeling a little bit herky-jerky that I haven't really enjoyed very much. It has improved, but there's just something about the style that I'm not fully, you know, enamored with. I don't hate it, and it doesn't really take me out of it, but it's just something that's always kind of bugged me. Especially when it comes to like just certain details on like on character faces and things like that. I don't mind as much when it's like something involving action, because they've done a really good job of doing lightsaber fights and things like that with this animation style. But other stuff, I just, when it comes to like emotional sequences or things like that, I have a hard time, you know, staying connected to the characters. But there are cool moments throughout. I appreciate how this kind of like enhances some of the details that we know about certain time periods during the prequels and things like that. But I just thought that this was fine. Honestly, this kind of this feels like just like bonus materials from like a DVD release or something like that.
I mean, I see that because it does in a lot of ways, it's tying loose ends and showing you stuff that like we kind of assumed happened.
Yeah, or it feels like stuff that they're putting in to like maybe set up something that might come up later. So like this maybe makes more sense, or like it fills in a gap so you can be like, you know, it's that Star Wars thing of like, oh, that's why they're doing that.
It solves the one problem in The Mandalorian where Ahsoka's like, I only knew one other of his kind, so they had to get rid of Yaddle before Ahsoka joined the Order, right?
Yeah.
I didn't even think about that. Okay, Brian, what is your brief thoughts on this before we get into episode by episode?
So I really love the Clone Wars. I really love that style. It really grew on me over the years. You know, I was a little iffy on it when it started, but once I got into it, it really works for me. So I'm a little bit different from Brad there. But these stories all had a lot more interconnectivity than I expected. I expected them to just sort of be one-offs, but I think thematically and chronologically, there's a lot of really interesting themes that tie throughout them that made it a lot richer than I think I expected it to be. I expected it to be more of those DVD extra one-off shorts, kind of like Visions was, where they like had very little relation to one another. But I think that there was something really powerful about choosing these two particular Jedi to tell these particular stories about in the context of this 6-episode arc.
You know, one thing I wasn't expecting is to for it to be told in chronological order?
Largely chronological order. I think the first one is out of chronological order.
Oh, is it?
Well, I think Ahsoka is definitely born probably after Qui-Gon's time as a Padawan. She's only 15 or 16 when Clone Wars starts, and the Qui-Gon that they used in that first Dooku short is...
Yeah, he felt like that was like a 20-something Qui-Gon.
Yeah, so if we were going strict chronological order, it would probably be switched with the Ahsoka episode going second. And my guess is that's probably how they wanted to do it, and Disney Plus was like, no, everybody loves Ahsoka, and she disappears for three episodes, so let's just switch those and give people a taste.
Yeah, well, that first episode is better than the second episode, too, so it's... Okay, let's. Did you have anything else to say in your brief thoughts before we get into it?
No, I think it really fits really well with the canon and adds some new stuff that I think is interesting. And anybody who has some arguments about where it fits in the canon, I'm happy to have those conversations.
Okay, the first episode is called Life and Death, and it's directed by Nathaniel Villanueva, who has directed six episodes of Bad Batch, four episodes of Clone Wars. He started as a story artist on Ultimate Spider-Man and was also a storyboard artist on Star Wars Rebels. And this is written by Dave Filoni, as most of these episodes are, all except for one of them. So I'm not going to do a break. We're not going to do a breakdown of the episodes, kind of like how we do with every other show. I'm just going to recap the plot very briefly. So Ahsoka is born and taken into a traditional, like on a traditional hunting quest a year later by her mother. And she's kidnapped by a tiger-like creature, only to be returned to the town, having taken control of the creature using the Force, leading her mother and the tribe to learn that she is to be a Jedi. I love that... how we kind of get to discover like the wonders of this world through the baby Ahsoka's eyes, like those plants that spit out those like dandelions and stuff like that. I do think it's probably a little too early to take your daughter on a trip where you murder a deer before her eyes.
I thought
1 year old.
This felt like a cultural thing, though. It felt like something that they like, yeah. Because when they're like, has it been a year already? Like, it feels like a rite of passage and something really, really interesting there. And this episode really dripped with those Princess Mononoke touchstones that Dave Filoni is so interested in.
Okay, Brian, I do want to ask you this. Anytime a woman character is introduced into Star Wars canon, there's always speculation online of who she's related to, who's the mother, who's the do you know what I mean? Like, oh, Jyn Erso looks a lot like, you know, all that kind of stuff. Why is it that Ahsoka's parents have never been part of fan speculation? Is it because she's a Togruta or whatever?
I think it's just, I mean, A, there aren't a whole lot of Togruta characters. And it's not like people are going to go like, oh, Shakti must be her mother. But the way they established the Jedi Order was very much like, she's taken as a kid, and then we sort of slowly got those pieces of that story about Plo Koon finding her. So it was like, we knew she was with her people on some dirt planet, you know? So, like, who cared, right?
Yeah.
It's because she's not a brunette with dark eyes who could potentially be related to half the galaxy.
Yeah, exactly.
Brad, any thoughts on this episode in particular?
I like this episode. This was one of the ones I think I appreciated the most out of this batch. Even though I'm not a big anime person, I occasionally do like its aesthetic when applied to certain kinds of stories. And like Brian said, this one did feel like it emulated Princess Mononoke. And I'm kind of a sucker for these kinds of stories. Actually, you know, when like it taps into like the cultural elements of these characters and like their connection with nature and things like that. So I'm not necessarily like huge into the idea of, you know, us necessarily needing an origin story like this, but these, I think starting right off with this one, this feels like and not just because they're animated, but this feels definitely geared towards the younger Star Wars audience to kind of like instill like lessons intended for younger people through the lens of Star Wars. And I think if anything, that's one of the things that's probably its most successful at doing. And that might be part of the reason why I just didn't get caught up in it as much as I would something like Clone Wars or Rebels. But it's, yeah, it was solid.
Yeah. I will say that Baby Ahsoka has nothing on Baby Yoda, Grogu.
I mean, a computer animated baby is never going to be as cute as, you know, a puppet creature. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, Grogu even looks cute in like the animated form whenever you see like the merchandise and stuff.
That's true. But hey, speaking of cute, what are those little creatures the hopping dog around things? Eating treats? Because initially I thought those were Lothcats, but they're not. They're something different. They're like, they seem like they're kind of dogs, but also kind of cats.
They reminded me of. The impression I got was that they were sort of a different breed of those toucas, right? Something crossed between like a panda bear and a touca.
Nice. Yeah, they were super cute. I would definitely get a plush of one of those.
Oh, me too. I hope that they're sold in the creature stall at some point on Batuu. I'd totally buy them. Can we talk about the old woman in the town? Like, what is her role? Is she like the tribal leader? Is she the grandmother of Ahsoka? And by the way, how great were like the wrinkles on her face? I don't know, that in particular, I guess, starting out this episode with like the background that looked like a matte painting, and then you saw like her face, that is what like struck me as like, wow, this is it felt like a leap above what we saw in Clone Wars.
See, that was one of the textures that I actually didn't like very much, but it's only because I think Coco did it so much better with the grandmother in that movie.
Yeah, well, if you're gonna compare it to anything to Coco, you're gonna, everything's gonna lose.
You know, it's interesting though too, you think about the production time you get on a feature film versus a TV show.
Oh, for sure.
And they're pulling off miracles for the TV production time budget that they're working with.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I think to answer your question too, Peter, like, she seems like she's like the elder of this settlement, you know, and so like she's the one who everyone looks to and has this this air of respect that's paid to her and kind of oversees the well-being of everybody.
Have we seen have we gotten any time with these kind of people in Star Wars canon before? This kind of tribe or this kind of alien species?
Not with them on their planet. I mean, we've definitely had some stuff with Shaak Ti. The Togruta did feature in the High Republic. I want to say the Fallen Star sort of featured them as they were first starting to come into the Republic, and they were led very much by a queen. And they were sort of trying to stay out of galactic politics. And I need to do some more research to refresh my memory, because I hadn't thought that question would come up. But there is, you know, a couple of hundred years prior to this, their first exposure to the Republic and how they entered it.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to spend some more time in that world. It seems interesting. And I also want to say the music in this episode was exceptional. And it's the same guy that does Rebels.
Kevin Kiner, yeah. He really knocked it all out of the park. Like, he brought everything he had to these episodes.
Okay, there's a shot late in the episode where a gun falls to the ground and there's a close-up of it. And I was wondering, did I miss the metaphorical significance of that? Because it seemed like very something that they were trying to show.
I mean, I don't know what you missed. no,
it did feel like a strange insert shot, because like you didn't necessarily need to focus on the dropping of the gun for him to, you know, run over and make sure that you know, that they were okay. But like it lingered on it for some reason. I agree.
What I got out of it, and again, this could be me reading too closely though, was the similarities between like what's important and him discarding the gun and going after like the loved ones rather than continuing to fight.
But they also didn't really need to fight at that point anymore, because like everything was fine, you know. Like I think that would have hit better if there was more significance to him dropping the gun, but he still could have easily just ran over there with the gun in his hand and made sure that they were fine.
Yeah, sometimes an insert shot's just an insert shot.
That's true.
I feel like there was something there that just didn't work or didn't get relayed. I don't know. I didn't catch it. The other thing I would like to say is it's cool that to see someone who gets discovered to have force powers, and it's like, that's a wonderful thing. It's not like, oh, they're different. Oh, like, it's not like the X-Men thing of like, oh, they're, you know, I don't know. It was cool to see the tribe like be happy about that.
It's definitely a stark contrast to like the blatant kidnapping that the First Order does, because I know that there have been in the prequels or the sequels lines drawn between what the Jedi do in taking kids and how Palpatine might try to go about it during the Clone Wars and how the First Order goes about it during their time to create the Stormtrooper Corps. So it's absolutely, especially since so many of them are force sensitive, which you know, is interesting. But yeah, no, seeing these folks be like, oh, this is great, she's going to bring honor to us, is really cool. There's some really interesting ideas about that stuff that have sort of come in and out of the canon over the years. I know in Mike Stackpole's X-Wing books, he explored this a little bit with Corran Horn, in that like Corellians, when they got chosen to be Jedis and they made Jedi Knight, like they would mint coins for the family, and the family would get to carry those around as this mark of pride. You know, it's cool to see that kind of stuff filtering back into the universe.
Okay. That is the first episode. Did either of you have anything else to say about it before we move into episode two?
No.
Okay.
I was going to say it looks better on the big screen. This was the episode they showed at Celebration.
Oh, the first one?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Episode two is named Justice. It's directed by Saul Ruiz, who you're going to get to know a lot of in the series. He did episodes of Bad Batch, Clone Wars, Resistance, Rebels. He started as a cinematic animator on Force Unleashed 2, the video gaming. And this is also written by Dave Filoni. And this one follows Master Dooku and his apprentice, Qui-Gon Jinn, as they attempt to free a senator's son who is being held hostage by the people of a town. And they learn that the situation is quite a lot more complex politically. It's basically the beginning of Dooku's disillusionment with the Jedi working with the Senate, is what I kind of take from it. Brad, what is your thoughts on this episode?
This episode was fine. I get a little frustrated just because, like, I wish sometimes shows would, like, I don't know, let villains be like villainous rather than trying to like fill in like reasoning like behind their villainy. And I understand, like, it's, you know, you want a villain to be fully fleshed out and so that you understand that he's not evil just for the sake of being evil, but like there's some motivation behind it and what they think that they're doing is right. But for me, like, I don't know, like seeing like Dooku in this capacity, like it kind of, I don't know, it took away some of the menace from him for me a little bit. But I will say, I think that I was impressed at the character design for this younger version of Qui-Gon Jinn, because there are elements of his face that really do resemble the facial features of a young Liam Neeson, especially in the eyes.
Interestingly enough, it's voiced by Liam Neeson's son.
Yes, that's also very cool.
Okay, I do have to ask you, was the fact that that character is Qui-Gon Jinn supposed to be a reveal at the end of the episode?
Yeah, I think it's meant to be, like, I think that, and this is another thing that made me feel like this is geared towards kids, because I feel like a lot of kids probably aren't going to realize that right away, but like adults immediately are going to know that that's Qui-Gon Jinn, because I noticed that they don't say his name until the very like last moment of this episode. So that's clearly meant to be something where kids are going to be like, oh, it's Qui-Gon.
So I want to push back a little on something you said though, Brad, about like how they're trying to humanize the villains and they should just let villains be villains. But I think the story is kind of necessary in Dooku's arc at the point where you have him, like, I mean, they baked this into his background in Attack of the Clones, where he was a Jedi. Yeah. He was trained by Yoda and he did leave the Order, and everyone thought that it was his disillusion of politics that did that. But you see that there was something more sinister at work from the very beginning. And the only two people that were witness to that were Qui-Gon and Yaddle. And Qui-Gon dies and isn't able to say, like, no, like, Dooku probably is going to take things too far because he's dead. And when Yaddle discovers it, obviously that causes problems for her.
Well, also Windu.
Well, but Windu is like, I don't know, like, Windu's just sort of wishy-washy about it and doesn't necessarily, like, he knows he's not the best at following orders, but he's not the best at following orders in the same way Qui-Gon might be. Right? Where it's like, Windu's like, we're going to do the letter of the council law and that's it. And Dooku's like, well, why don't we investigate a little bit? It's very much the same situation with, like, Anakin and Obi-Wan in Attack of the Clones. There was so much Attack of the Clones in that episode. But no, this first episode with Qui-Gon and Dooku, I just really loved the aesthetic of it. It felt like those scenes in Throne of Blood, right?
What do you mean?
Like the mist everywhere, the rundown shacks, some sort of like evil presence, and even like, I don't know, like I it felt very Kurosawa to me. Even the music too, the music had that vibe to it. Like a lot of these episodes had that Kurosawa music vibe to it.
Do we know what this planet is? Like, is this something that...
Oh, Raxus Secundus has appeared in the canon before. And I will tell you, Raxus was where... This is where a lot of stuff with Quinlan Vos and... Quinlan Vos and Asajj Ventress did some stuff there. Trying to assassinate Dooku, but this was actually the capital of the Separatist Senate. So Ahsoka goes here with Padme, and that's where she meets Lux Bonteri in the Clone Wars.
So I guess my question to you is, did the town suffer and continue, or did it get better?
Am I confusing Raxus Secundus? It's the second one. No, this is the one with the... Am I right? Like, or
I don't know.
Maybe I know Raxus Secundus comes into one of these three episodes, and I thought it was this one, but it might be the one
with Mace Windu. You might be right. I think it might be the next one. I did not write down the planet on this one.
Let me check my notes because I know I totally did. And yep, that's the next episode. Yet we don't know anything about this village. Just to apply everything I said about Raxus Secundus to the next episode. My apologies.
So we have no idea if things got better for these town people.
Well, they probably joined the Separatists and Dooku made it better.
Okay. Brad, do you have anything else to say about Justice?
No, that's pretty much it.
I think I'll add that I like the big hulking droid that was named Tutan, I think.
Yeah.
And yeah, I thought he was gonna have a bigger play in this episode, but
this really exemplifies, though, like, George Lucas took a lot of flack in the opening crawl of Revenge of the Sith to say there are heroes on both sides and evil is everywhere. And this is another one of those examples of how people on both sides exhibit that evil and that corruption and that power. And I think it's a point that maybe Lucas didn't make as well as he could have in Revenge of the Sith on its own, but through Clone Wars and his work there and then continued with Filoni and stuff like this, really does show us that there are heroes on both sides and evil everywhere.
Okay, let's move on to episode 3, Choices. This one is directed by Charles Murray, who is a live action director. He did The Summoning, A Cold Hard Truth, The Devil You Know. But he also has written a couple episodes of Clone Wars and Rebels. This being his first animated directorial thing, that's probably why he has a co-director credit here. Saul Ruiz, who directed a couple of the other episodes, he's co-director here. And this episode also is the only episode that wasn't written by Filoni. It's written by Murray and Elon Murray, who is either his brother or sister or of some relation. I did not look it up. But anyways, I'm going to say that this episode was probably my least favorite of the series. I think the mystery of who's the murderer kind of suffers from the short running time. It's kind of like resolved really quickly. And I feel like the notes of what's going on with Dooku is kind of like the same as the notes in the last episode. And I kind of wish, instead of something like this, we got to see Dooku actually making the deal with Sidious. Do you know what I mean? Like, we actually got to see that moment instead of this moment. Because I feel like the last moment in the last episode is the same note as this of why he's getting pushed.
I think, though, that like what they did is they actually took the previous episode and it was Dooku becoming frustrated with the corruption in the Senate. And then the second episode, and Qui-Gon's able to bring him back from that, right? Then in this episode, it's his frustration with the corruption of the Jedi. And Qui-Gon's not there anymore to bring him back from that. And he lost that grounding. And so I think taken together, these episodes work really well as companions on that thematic level.
Fair enough. See, this is why I love talking to you, Brian, because we have these discussions where I feel like I come out with a different opinion. Maybe not your exact opinion, but you are challenging the way I viewed this episode. What else did you think about this episode?
I thought it was a curious choice to pair Dooku with Windu, and that was really why I was kind of trying to figure out why they were doing it, and that's when I kind of hit upon that idea of that contrast. But they're very much an odd pair, and the ending really worked for me, where it's like Dooku thinks that Windu's just following rules to get onto the council, and that this is somehow a reflection on Dooku's inadequacy and his ego, especially when Mace Windu keeps saying, like, no, there's no ego in this. And Dooku feels a little bit taken aback that Windu is getting this spot on the council.
Brad, your thoughts on Choices?
This is one of those things, too, where, like, I really started to feel the idea that this was just, like, meant to be these like gap fillers, and I almost feel like I would have appreciated like just a short form season like this that focused, you know, entirely on Dooku and told like a more fully fleshed out story instead of giving us these moments. Like, obviously we know a decent amount about Dooku because of the prequels, you know, and other media that has given us details, but like I guess I would have liked more of like a bigger arc rather than seeing like these little moments that just like kind of just explain things. That I think that's my overall frustration with this, is like these are all just like they feel like footnotes on a Wikipedia page or something like that, that explain stuff that we didn't necessarily need to know, but just like kind of help a little bit, I guess, to explain things. And that's kind of what this felt like for me.
The other thing I wanted to talk about is the Jedi funeral thing at the end, where like this light comes out of the coffin that is in the ground. Is that something we've ever seen before? I don't think so.
Yeah, no, we have seen that in Clone Wars. I want to say season 4 or 5.
Oh, okay.
And it's interesting, though, how Yoda's cameos through this were all mute because there were some Jedi that died in Clone Wars, and Yoda was the one who sort of spoke at the funeral, and they brought in a hooded Ki-Adi Mundi to do it. And I think that's an acknowledgement that Dave Filoni didn't want to recast the voice of Yoda in deference to Tom Kane, who was in every episode of Clone Wars, and he had a, I think, like a stroke or something, and has lost his ability to perform.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So all of those instances where Yoda was in the narrative were sort of particularly poignant, especially since that's the reason I think we didn't hear Yoda speak, is that Filoni wouldn't recast it the way he did, the way he did with, frankly, Palpatine in these episodes.
I wondered why we didn't hear him say anything in the later episode with Ahsoka.
Yeah, I think that's your reason. I think it's that Tom Kane is unable to do the voice, and Filoni didn't want to recast it.
So is this funeral thing, or like the funeral pyre in Return of the Jedi where they burn Anakin's body, but it's like a more technological thing where it happens in like a casket and then the light, is it representing, what is going on here is I guess what I'm really asking.
I mean, like, the visuals that we see here aren't much more detailed than the visuals we saw in Clone Wars. My impression was that this was them cremating the body in the temple.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I was wondering too, is it felt like it was like that's their way of doing the cremation. I wasn't sure if it was just more ceremonial than that, but yeah.
Okay. That's episode 3 choices. Do you guys have anything else to add on that one? Seems like not. Okay, so episode 4 is The Sith Lord. And guess what, guys? This is directed by Saul Ruiz again. He was doing some heavy lifting on the series. It's written by Dave. And this one was about Dooku, who has been pushed to the dark side, having to deal with the loss of his apprentice, Qui-Gon, and deal with Yaddle, who suspects that he has something going on. There's some evil plans. I don't know. This episode here is the definition of how this series kind of attempts to just close a bunch of loose ends. Like in the prequels, they never really did like spell out what was going on with the Kamino being deleted from the Jedi archives. Like, It was a thread that was followed, and obviously we knew Sifo Dyas and all that, but like it was not really like, it was like a mystery that was never came to like a satisfying conclusion, I felt.
Yeah, and also this especially felt like frustrating to me too, because but also kind of funny, because I love that immediately after he does this, he talks to Jocasta New, so it's almost like a in your face kind of moment, because like she's so cocky about like it not being in the Jedi archives, like if it's not here it doesn't exist, and it's like, you just talked to the guy who deleted it.
That's funny. I didn't even think about that.
I loved that. The thing that made me really excited about this was that it shows us exactly where in the timeline this happens, right?
Yeah.
And that Palpatine's grand plan and his work with Dooku started well before Maul ever died, right? Like, Dooku got recruited well before Phantom Menace started. And because the clones had to have been started before Phantom Menace started.
Yeah, yeah. But that's something we had assumed, right?
We had assumed it, but also how... Dooku's not a Jedi at this point anymore. Dooku's already left the Order. And they sort of covered this in the Star Wars Padawan book, that he's still sort of welcomed by the Jedi, even though he's like renounced his actual knighthood and sort of treated with respect and dignity there. But I love that they place it at the moment where Qui-Gon is the report.
Yeah, yeah. I will say I did like that. And that's one of the things that actually made me wish that they would have done something more and fleshed out the timeline a little bit, just to have like a bit more of a complete story. Like, it was frustrating to me getting the little pieces as opposed to getting something that felt a little more, you know, complete. Yeah.
And there was that great moment too with him and Qui-Gon, where Qui-Gon tells him how great Obi-Wan is and sort of references Qui-Gon always speaking very highly of him when he finally has Obi-Wan in you know, bondage in on Geonosis.
Yeah.
And I do love that this episode kind of plays alongside Phantom Menace and into, I guess, Clone Wars? I mean, Attack of the Clones? Right?
No, I mean, Attack of the Clones happens a decade after this.
Yeah, this
okay,
one,
so,
this,
so, ha- this, so this it's just Phantom Menace.
Yeah, this one is just Phantom Menace because it ends, the end of it is when, Dooku has learned that Qui-Gon is dead.
Yeah, because that's and actually that's why Yaddle starts talking to him, like, they're sort of inviting him to the funeral, and he's like, I don't think my presence would be welcome.
Yeah.
By the way, have we ever seen Yaddle talk in canon? Because I was kind of shocked that, first of all, she's voiced by Bryce Dallas Howard, and number two, that she doesn't talk like Yoda.
Yeah.
So, I think this is sort of, this answers one of the questions people have about, like,
Grogu,
what Grogu might speak like. And it's really like your accent and the way you speak and your diction is all really like predicated on how you learn in the first place. And so Yoda probably was, you know, around in his hometown for a lot longer than Yaddle was before joining the Order.
Oh, interesting. So maybe the species do speak backwards, but for whatever reason, the only other one we've met who talks so far doesn't speak like Yoda does.
Well, if Yoda ended up in the Jedi Order, like, at age 60 or 70, right? Like, 20 years older than Grogu, but Yaddle ends up there as a 10-year-old, right?
Yeah.
She's not going to have the same verbal baggage that he does because he spent so much more time in that culture.
That's interesting. I wonder
it's like someone that was like born in England and moves to the States before learning language, and they speak, you know, like an American or speak like, you know, with the American accent.
Do you think that's a question they'll ever answer, Brian?
Where they come from or where Yoda was in there?
I mean, I guess both. I guess, like, will they ever reveal more about Yoda's species? And then will we ever like find out if Yoda and like his family are the only ones who speak that in that unique way?
I don't think they'll get into it. I think Yoda works much better as mysterious.
Yeah.
And you'd have to go back like 800 years in Star Wars for that. And I mean, like, it seems like 300 or 400 years back is about as far as they're going right now.
Yeah.
So maybe, who knows?
Okay, we get this confrontation between Dooku and the Emperor, which is kind of cool. And then this epic Yaddle-Dooku lightsaber battle, which I just was not expecting at all. Because, you know, Brian, I know that you've seen the prequel so many times.
Once or twice.
But aside from Phantom Menace, I don't think I've seen Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith that much. I've seen it a handful of times. And I always, in the back of my mind, was like, oh, I thought Yaddle probably died in Order 66 or something. So this confrontation ending with her death was kind of surprising to me.
So here's the thing about Yaddle. You'll notice if you watch Attack of the Clones again, by this time in Attack of the Clones, she's no longer on the council. No one says anything about her in the canon, at least in the current canon. There was definitely some stuff that happened with her in Legends. But after Phantom Menace, she never appears again. There are definitely some flashbacks and Force visions in the current canon that reference Yaddle, and there's an expectation that maybe she might have gotten away or maybe she was around. But it seems like There's nothing concrete. We never actually see her in the flesh again. And so I was kind of surprised to see her die because there were definitely some hints that maybe she could have survived Order 66. You know, here she is. And so this is as compelling a reason for her to no longer be on the Order as anything.
If only she could have sent a transmission about Dooku before, you know, back to the Jedi Council before her death, then all of Star Wars, except for Phantom Menace, would not have happened.
Yeah. I thought it was particularly brutal too. Like when he closes that door on her, I literally gasped like, holy shit. Like,
yeah,
that was rough. And then like the shot of him, like actually putting his blade into her, the music was very reminiscent of like the music this whole time actually felt very reminiscent of Anakin's Padme's ruminations from the Revenge of the Sith soundtrack. And you notice the lighting scheme and coloring of the Coruscant skyline is very much that same golden hour as when Anakin is making his final choice. So this episode being called Choices and reflecting the visual and auditory tone of Anakin having to make his choice in Revenge of the Sith, with Dooku here and being forced to make a choice to kill a Jedi from the council with Palpatine watching on, it felt like a really great bit of poetry.
Yeah. Okay. Episode 5, Practice Makes Perfect. Oh, you have something else to say?
Well, that was actually Ian McDiarmid and Liam Neeson as their characters, which this is Ian McDiarmid hasn't voiced Palpatine on the Clone Wars at all. It was always Ian Abercrombie, and then Tim Curry took over.
Yeah, I was actually surprised to hear both of them provide their voices as well, especially since they didn't get any of the other like key characters back. Because I just thought that was surprising.
Well, Liam Neeson has been pretty vocal about like he doesn't want anybody else playing Qui-Gon.
Yeah.
So I mean, he came back for Clone Wars. And obviously now we know he came back for Kenobi, so.
No, that's very cool. Okay, episode 5, Practice Makes Perfect, again directed by Saul Ruiz and written by Dave Filoni. And I think this might be my second least favorite of these episodes. This is the one where Anakin gives Ahsoka a test against a troop of clone troopers, and she learns from it, and... And that's basically the.
I think story. This was my favorite, actually, of all of them.
I feel like the least amount of stuff actually happens.
Brian and I had to talk about this because we're planning like coverage about the show. Before like it comes out, and he actually said something that made me appreciate it a little bit more. And I'll let him talk about it so that
people. So, can... Anakin's test basically trains her how to escape custody in the Wrong Jedi and to survive Order 66. Right. In The Wrong Jedi, those episodes where Ahsoka is escaping from the clones chasing her down, shooting these stun blasts at her. If Anakin didn't put her through this training, they would have stunned her there, captured her, and kicked her out of the order then. Right. But she's able to escape because of that. And the moves that she's doing and the use of both lightsabers, because Anakin clearly gives her that second lightsaber in this training sequence to make sure that she can stand up against them even harder. And he says, you know, she's like, battle droids aren't half as good as these guys. And she's like, and Anakin's like, yeah. And if you can stand up to Rex and the boys, you can handle anything. And that's exactly what she has to do. That foreshadowing of her having to stand up exactly to Rex and these particular guys who are so impressed by her and so into her. It's such an emotional thing to think that they trained her to avoid Order 66 right then and there. And then how much more emotional is it that we get that other view of the scene from Order 66 where Rex has had his chip removed and they open that door and all of these men that helped train her to do this and to survive to that point are wearing the paint from her mask at that time. Like, it's amazing and it's really emotional. And I got really overwhelmed watching the episode connecting all those dots.
Well, you have definitely made me appreciate this episode a little bit more. I will say, I guess I'm just a little confused by the storytelling because in the beginning of the episode, there's this test at the beginning with training remotes. And it looked like she did a good job, but then like Anakin's disappointed in her.
Anakin wasn't disappointed in her, and he says straight out he was disappointed in the test.
Yeah, he says it's a bad test. It's he doesn't think that it tests her skills enough to really be helpful for her as part of her training.
Oh, okay. I did. That was not clear to me.
And the other thing is that Caleb Doom is there watching. Like Kanan Jarrus is there watching this test.
Yeah, that's cool. I will say that the power of some of these episodes comes. it requires you to have relationships with these characters and to know the other stories coming in, because that ending, like everything you said, your interpretation of this episode, and even I, who I thought this was, until hearing your interpretation, I thought it was one of the weaker episodes. You know, I got emotional at the ending because I know what the ending means. But if you haven't seen Clone Wars, that ending means nothing to you. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, this episode's like, that's a weird way to end it.
No, because it didn't have like a resonance for me because I haven't seen, you know, all of like Clone Wars and Rebels and whatnot. But like, I still know enough like to get the context of that. So I agree with you. And that's another big reason why this feels like something that's not incomplete, because this is obviously what their intention of the show was, but it's what makes me want more, you know, like something that feels like it doesn't rely on knowing all this other stuff, you know, to really appreciate it.
I will say this about the series. I was expecting to come out of this being like, I wish instead that this was like a full length series where like there was a 30 minute episode on Ahsoka, a 30 minute episode on Dooku. And I came away really liking the shorts because it really forces them to be concise with the storytelling and what they're trying to relay. And there's not moments of filler. Yeah. There's never moments of filler. It always feels like everything is deliberate.
It draws connections between the similarities between Dooku and Ahsoka in really fascinating ways I hadn't thought about too.
How's that?
Right. Like, well, So Dooku becomes disillusioned with the Jedi and leaves to go join the Sith. Ahsoka becomes disillusioned with the Jedi and leaves to try to be a dirt farmer because she's sick of fighting. And the two of them, I really loved that idea of like the funeral imagery where it was important for Ahsoka to show up at Padme's funeral and she wasn't going to miss it. Right, where Dooku had divorced himself from that attachment completely and wouldn't go to Qui-Gon's funeral. And so you see these touch points with these characters sort of drifting in different ways from the, I don't want to say abuse because I don't think it's as far as abuse, but like from the dogma of the Jedi Order mistreating them.
Yeah. Let's get to episode 6, Resolve. This is, again, directed by Saul Ruiz. It's written by Dave. And this is about Ahsoka, who almost gets caught at Padme's funeral. And Bail gives her a way to connect with him in the future, which leads to a situation later where she's uncovered to be a Jedi and found by an Inquisitor. She ends up contacting Bail for help, which leads to her being part of the formation of the Rebellion. So I really like this episode. It had a lot of cool moments, like seeing her at the funeral. The ending just hit all the right emotional notes. Should we just make it a rule now that a Jedi in hiding will always be forced to use their powers in a situation in public to save or help someone and then get noticed? Because I feel like that's a trope that has now become like a big thing in Star Wars.
Have you forgotten? This is how Jedi hunt themselves.
And this is also, they also have to do blue collar work. None of them are going and like working, you know, in a library or, you know, doing anything, you know, other than like working in very, you know, dirty and like just rough conditions.
They're so educated and so smart, but I guess maybe those positions require like a resume that would be traced, like that they can't easily. I'm guessing the blue collar work, like, you know, doesn't require.
It's a rural area too. You know, yeah. There's not a ton of people around. Like they're not there. It's probably a bad idea for, you know, Ahsoka or Obi-Wan to go like work in the city.
Yeah, like Obi-Wan's not going to go like, I have a lot of skills at negotiation. And like, what's he going to do? Sell used speeders?
Give out loans?
Yeah.
Brad, what did you think of this episode?
Yeah, I thought this was cool, you know, in the but like also kind of simple. It really feels just like a 15 minute version of like the entire season of Obi-Wan, basically. You know, like Ahsoka is definitely following pretty much the same path that Obi-Wan does in his series. You know, there's not the same stakes or tension because it's not, you know, Obi-Wan versus Vader. But yeah, I the visuals were very cool here. The score was fantastic. You know, the final confrontation is something that's very cool. So yeah, I did enjoy this episode for the most part.
I will say thematically, I'm not sure what pulls her back in. I understand her losing her friend was something that like really probably meant a lot to her. But like she literally helped someone out with her force powers and that person betrayed her and sent inquisitors after her. And she was like, sure, now I'll join the rebellion.
Well, that the person she saved didn't betray her. It was the significant other of the person who betrayed her. Right. So I think for me, from my perspective was, is that what really drew her in, I think is, and Brian, maybe you have a different reading, but I think it's maybe she realizes that no matter where she goes, like there's always going to be somebody who is willing to do something like that and will bring her back in. And maybe rather than putting more people in danger, she would just, you know, confront it head on and just go back to it.
I think that's, I mean, I think that's the read. And I think it's a very compressed sort of retelling of what happens in E.K. Johnston's Ahsoka book. The details are a little bit different and there's probably two ways you could look at it, right? Where it's like, this is just a retelling, a slight retelling of what happens in that book, or Ahsoka ends up on two different farms and taking down two different inquisitors. But really watching innocents get put into danger over and over again because the Empire is relentless in their hunt of her, or any Jedi, is really enough to motivate her to say, okay, I have to fight. I don't have a choice. Because I think one of the things that Star Wars stands for on like sort of a personal political level is the idea that doing nothing aids the oppressor and that you have to stand up at some point. And where's that line where you stand up? And, you know, for Ahsoka, it's a lot sooner than someone like, say, Cassian Andor.
Can we talk about the Inquisitor? Is this an Inquisitor we've ever seen before? Because I like how cool his like vulture like mask looks.
No, this is new for the show. It feels like a slightly different Inquisitor than was documented in E.K. Johnston's book, but the story team has been upfront from the very beginning of the new canon that there are going to be differences in interpretations between media, that it's going to be designed for the media it's in, and slight details will change because of that.
Yeah, because a lot of people initially thought when this character appeared in the trailer that this was the sixth brother. But Johnston came out and said that it was a new Inquisitor, so it wasn't exactly the same character that had appeared in that book.
And I mean, I'm stating the obvious here, but I'm guessing the ending, we're supposed to believe that this is how Ahsoka became Fulcrum.
There's a much more detailed version of the story that involves R2 and a reunion with R2 and Ahsoka in that Ahsoka book, but essentially she does connect with Bail Organa and he puts her on that path one way or the other.
Yeah. Anything else left to say about episode 6 Resolve?
It was cool. I loved that the flaming, again, coming back to the Kurosawa, sort of the flaming background of the farm felt very much like some of the scenes in Seven Samurai.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy that.
And I also loved in this case too, just how cocky this Inquisitor was, and Ahsoka just has no problem just getting rid of him.
he was so happy to see her though. He was
That was another thing that reminded me of Seven Samurai. It was very much the fight between Kyuzo, the swordsmaster, and the guy who's like, no, I'm better than everybody. And Kyuzo just like makes the sparest movements possible. And, you know, the guy's like, well, we'll call it a draw. And this fight felt very much like that, where like this guy was so arrogant, he didn't realize that he was fighting against a master. And that's what Ahsoka has become at this point.
Okay. Let's get into speculation here. Do you guys think that there's going to be a season 2 of this? Do you think there'll be more?
I think so. This feels like the kind of thing where they could easily, especially because it's such short form, that they could use other Jedi characters to start filling in other gaps. Because personally, one of the things I was most excited about, and a little bit disappointed in to some extent when we saw like the trailer for this finally, is that it focused on Ahsoka and Dooku. Because for me, I was more interested in seeing like the stories of like Ki-Adi Mundi and Plo Koon and stuff like that expanded. And I hope that they do that in the future if they continue the series.
So at Celebration, Athena Portillo was kind of talking, and Dave Filoni were talking about how, like, you know, Disney was just sort of giving money for things that they could get off the ground, and she found the money from Disney to allow Dave to do this. If it does well, I can imagine that they would find more money to do it.
Okay, then I guess the question is, if more money falls off that truck, which I'm sure it will, what other Jedi would you like to see this done with? One of the most fascinating parts of this was, for me, is that episode that goes alongside Phantom Menace. You know, it makes me wonder, and this is all done in the prequel era, could you do this for the original trilogy era? I mean, technically there's no other Jedi, but there are.
Well, but you could do it through the Empire. You could do Obi-Wan and Kanan at the same time.
Yeah. And you could also do Anakin, or yeah, you could, there's other ways of doing it. Could you do it in the sequel trilogy era? What would you guys like to see?
I would like to see a sequel to the sequel trilogy with Rey and Finn.
What is going on in your background?
Yeah, what was that?
I would say, like, I get, my kid came in with a phone with another kid on the phone. Sorry about that.
I'm leaving that in, Brian. I'm leaving that in. Okay. Yeah. What other characters would you like to see done if they do further episodes of this?
I'd love to see a High Republic show this way.
It could be interesting.
But I think the spirit of it is to talk, like, the relation of characters to the Jedi Order.
What I would like to see, well, yeah, this is, but I feel like that's only just because it's the prequel era of this season of it.
But that's why it would be interesting to do like Rey and Finn, because like, how do they reestablish their relationship to the Jedi Order?
Well, what I would like to see is Ben Solo. I would like to see the like some of the stuff we haven't seen with him and Luke, and the rebuilding of the Jedi Temple and the Knights of Ren. Like, I would like to see some of that. I know it's played out in comics and some books and stuff like that, but I feel like people don't read anymore. So I'd like to see it in this show.
And I don't necessarily know if this is something that they're planning on touching on in Ahsoka or, you know, any of the other series set in the same time period. But this series feels like the perfect format and opportunity to like maybe show us a previous interaction between Luke and Ahsoka, since they obviously already know each other by the time we see them.
Oh, good point.
You know, in Book of Boba Fett.
And also you could touch into like the whole, I mean, they just recently did a book on this, but the, you know, Rey's parents and Luke with Lando, that whole stuff. I think there might be something you could pull from. But I don't know. I like the idea. It's kind of the weakest part of the show for me, but it's also the thing I like the most is the idea of this like tying up loose ends that we may have had with Star Wars stories, and getting to see like these moments that like we assumed happened, but now we get to see them happen.
Yeah, I hope they can do something more with it than just doing that, because I do wish there was a little bit more to latch onto.
Yeah, I was actually surprised when I opened up the thing and saw the lengths of the episodes. I thought when we were getting these shorts, I thought they'd all be at least half episode length.
Same.
But like Practice Makes Perfect was like, with credits, 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's really short. I mean, altogether, this is probably like an hour? Maybe even
it's
less.
Like,
than an hour,
I think it's
right?
Like an hour and 15 minutes total.
Wow. I really wonder if Disney Plus is going to continue to keep on pushing like short form content on their platform, because it's so hard to market and even put a tile on like the platform, like the Groot stuff. They have like a tile for each one of the shorts because they don't like. It's not a series here. At least it's going to be a series. I don't know. It just seems like such a weird thing, but I guess you know, the money for an hour in 10 minutes of shorts is a lot less money than it is to do a season of television.
Yeah.
In the animated. So, yeah. Anything else left to say before we go?
No, I enjoyed it. I hope they do more.
Yeah. I also hope they do more. I enjoyed it. I had very low expectations, and when everything kind of like connected into things that I cared about, I don't know, even the first episode, which isn't really that additive to canon in any way. It's just cool. It was just a cool moment to witness in Ahsoka's backstory. So, you can find more of all of our work at slashfilm.com. You can find this podcast in Apple, Google, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. Please subscribe to our newsletter. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Please also, if you have feedback, questions, comments, concerns, speculation, send it to peter@slashfilm.com and rate and read this podcast in Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends, spread the word, and we will see you tomorrow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.